Hello, this is our podcast for our class number 17 on Monday the 25th. And in this class, we finished up cause and fact and started in on proximate cause. So make sure that you're all clear on what we accomplished. We're moving our way through our elements of a cause of action for negligence, duty, breach, cause and fact, and then we'll move to proximate cause. So that's how I want you to approach any analysis of a cause of action. You have to go through the elements. Don't assume anything. Leap through the important ones you're going to spend time on, where there's issues, where it's a problem. The easy ones you can get out of the way in a second, but you have to always tell me why you're making the conclusion. If you want to say there's a duty, why? You want to say there's a cause and fact, why? So, and the why is using the facts of the individual case. But to get back to class, the case that we talked about in class tonight was the Heimovitz case. And it's a, I don't know if I want to say one of a kind, but it followed because there were other cases, it followed a line of cases, but it was a sweeping policy-based case to deal with a problem in law, and we don't like problems. We have to, at the end of the day, always, we have to come up with some kind of conclusion. The court has to make a decision. We had seriously injured plaintiffs from the drug DES had been taken by their mothers. All the mothers were pregnant, so all of the children potentially, all of the female children, of course, potentially had DES-related cancer. In this case, as opposed to some of the others, the agent, the causative agent, and I just use that term to mean what caused the injury, was not at issue. We know the DES did. But what was at issue was who was the exact manufacturer. And we can't just say, well, what difference does that make? Why do they have to show that? Because we need a defendant. We can't, everything that we've talked about has needed a defendant. And if we couldn't show who the defendant was or who had caused this, who had manufactured this, it would be unfair on the plaintiffs if we said there was no case, or the defendants who were all in some way responsible. Because remember, this is a product liability case, so we're not having to show negligence. We just have to say that a defective product was manufactured, and there's no doubt the DES was defective. It caused cancer. So the problem with this whole line of cases for the many, many hundreds of plaintiffs was that there was no way to pin down which manufacturer's pills, and there were 300 manufacturers, which manufacturer's pills the mothers of the plaintiffs took. So in order to remedy this real problem in law, the Sindel case in California had devised a theory of market share liability. That is, everyone in all of the 300 defendants who had placed pills on the market would be held responsible for their percentage of each individual's injuries, depending upon their percentage of the national market. And Heimovitz then followed Sindel and made some of its own decisions. And again, all of this is so policy-based. It is, we've turned around now tort liability, which was loss shifting, my loss is shifted to you, into a recovery scheme based on loss spreading. That is, spread the loss to everybody who is involved in this industry, market share, depending on your market share, and in order to compensate the plaintiff. So compensation became primary here. Remember, we always said compensation and deterrence. Maybe for future deterrence, but, again, this activity itself was already finished. Maybe deterrence for others who might have rushed ahead with their pills. But, again, these pills had been approved by the FDA. We'll talk about this as an issue in preemption later on as a defense. But the overall scheme here was a compensation scheme, and I maintain that it was more like insurance rather than tort. It was a compensation scheme. You would get something for your injury. So, some jurisdictions adopted this market share liability, other jurisdictions didn't. It was thought that New York went about as far as it could possibly go in its scheme, although the dissent had, or it was basically a concurrence that had another, wished it would be different, didn't dissent from the result, although the scheme would have been different, but basically just said, we want, market share liability is fine, but we want people to be able to get out of the market. All of these things we talked about are just decisions. And the court, I went back to the, I went back to that sentence out of the 532 Madison Avenue that says, the court has to draw a line. It's a policy which is trying to figure out how to spread the risk, how to spread the loss. It's a policy. And that really is behind this. A Heimovitz tries looks over all social responsibility for liability instead of our traditional tort notion that an individual plaintiff has caused an individual harm or an individual defendant's harm. It's a social responsibility. Everyone is going to be responsible for all the harms. So again, New York Times called Heimovitz one of the most far-reaching product liability rulings ever issued by an American court. I don't know if that's a good thing they considered, but it was a major case at the time. So that wrapped up our discussion on cause and fact. Notice that what we've done is talk about really the hardest cases. Cause and fact is a question of fact, not necessarily that hard, not always an issue in all the cases, but when it's hard, it's really hard. So the best thing for you is to go back, talk about, make sure you know the rules about but for substantial factor. How do you get around multiple defendants, ways to do that, concurrent action or concert of action, concerted action, indivisible injury, just all of these various ways that we have of holding one person liable for the injuries created by another, and then these difficult cases we've talked about. Moving on to proximate cause is not always an issue in every case, but when you come to something that's very, very seems attenuated and that's just stretched out from the main negligence, the question of proximate cause comes up. Where to draw the line on liability? And it's up to the facts of the case. Again, it's a question. I think it's a question of law and a question of fact to decide when does the defendant's responsibility for his or her negligent acts end. And I want to suggest that we're looking a way to determine this is to look at the expected result of the risky behavior, the negligent behavior. what did we expect this negligent behavior to result in? What kind of injury? Is the injury that actually resulted something that's very far away from that expected result? And that's when we start to look at proximate cause as a limitation on liability. And the way you always hear this termed is, what is the scope of the risk? Scope of the risk. And I sort of drew, I always think of it as a, here's your negligent, and then there's a big circle around that. You're responsible for something up to a certain point, but beyond that, you're beyond the scope of the risk created by the defendant negligent behavior. That's just how I've always visualized it. It's a separate question of duty. Remember, duty limits liability, but goes to negligence. Someone's behavior could be said to be the cause of some very foreseeable type of injury, but still may not be held liable because the law says the person was under no duty. So remember, I could give my guests liquor up and down the street, making them drunk, so they go out and get into an automobile accident. But the court says, I have no duty to that third party. Remember our Reynolds v. Hicks case. So duty is a limitation on liability, but it goes to negligence. This is a limit, proximate cause limits liability, but it goes to causation. You don't get to proximate cause until you establish negligence and cause in fact. And it's only when there's something unusual about the injury as it relates to the actions. So the requirement is not either cause in fact or legal cause, proximate cause, but both. You have to satisfy both. And I look to see again about issues that come up frequently. Maybe a good way to organize your thoughts on proximate cause. Is there anything unexpected about the extent of the harm that occurred? That's our Ben case, our case that involved the eggshell plaintiff. Is there anything unexpected about the type of the harm that occurs? It's going to be our Polemus and Wagonman that we'll get to on Wednesday. Anything unexpected about the plaintiff? That's our Paul's graph. Anything unexpected about how the harm came into place? Any intervening actions that might, what I call, break the causal chain, be a way to limit our scope of responsibility. Even though did something happen that limits the scope of the risk created? And here we're just always looking at what's the scope of the risk. Proximate cause. It's generally a question of law. The trier of fact has to, and that's the jury, determine as a matter of law if defendant's conduct will be considered responsible for the consequences that have in effect occurred. It's not a question of causation, but it's a question of fact. And as such, we send this to the jury, but you have to have given them all of the tools that they need. The jury needs proper instruction. Remember in Ben, our case where there had been a fender bender, the expected result was a bruise, you know, some bruising, maybe whiplash. Our plaintiff had a pre-existing heart condition, had a heart attack from the fender bender and died. But for the fender bender, they wouldn't have had that particular heart attack. But in Ben, the jury hadn't been instructed that you take your plaintiff as you find them. So they hadn't been instructed that the law was as a policy, that you are going to be liable for everything that resulted from all your pre-existing conditions, your eggshell skull, your hemophilia, your predisposition to schizophrenia, all the things you take your plaintiff as you find them. So the jury instruction had to be changed. We don't know what was going to be the end result, but we do know that the jury was instructed wrong in Ben. So that our general rule is that the defendant is only liable for expected risks. But in Ben, we saw that this rule is regularly ignored to allow recovery for unexpected harms when they follow an impact upon the person of the plaintiff. When there's been a physical injury to the person, the courts are will allow recovery for some very unforeseeable, unexpected physical harms, because our policy is that if any physical harm could have been expected, the defendant will be liable for all physical harm. The law will individualize. A deserving plaintiff gets full recovery. Plaintiff suffers death where a normal person would only have a lump in the head or a bruise on the chest. Full recovery. So the courts, when we're talking about extent, unexpected extent, and, you know, again, we figured the type of harm would have been a physical injury, but it went way beyond the extent that we would have expected. Courts will say, you take your plaintiff as you find them. Otherwise, a negligent defendant's going to benefit from the luck of hitting someone. If we say, oh, you hit somebody and they have a heart attack, well, then you're not going to be responsible for the death. I mean, it's great, you know. You know, they die, but what the heck? And if we put our person up as the, you know, the perfectly healthy 25-year-old who would only, you know, you hit them in the fender bender and they laugh and drive away because they weren't injured at all. No, we individualize. We will individualize when it involves an impact to the person. So proximate cause will not limit recovery. Proximate cause will not limit recovery. And we talked about the, but there may be, it will not limit recovery, will not say that they're not going to be liable, but we can individualize again when it comes to damages. Maybe they're liable for, you know, less of a life, less of a time of life. If they were, again, your negligent driving hits a car, it was a plaintiff who was on his way to a hospice, sure death 3 days later. You're not going to be excused for death, but maybe only for worth of 3 days worth of life. So, again, these things come into question. The question is going to be, is it a question of proximate cause, that is no liability, or just will make allowances at the damage stays. And on page 402, we talked very briefly about Dillon v. Twin States. Boy falls from a high bridge on the way down to certain death, grabs a negligently non-insulated wire, and dies from electrocution on the way down. If he's by falling, he didn't have long to live or would have maimed, liable only for a limited earning capacity for the very short life. Very short life. But still liability. So next class, we're going to pick up on where I want to do some time, spend some time talking about subsequent medical injuries, just so you understand that. Again, the proximate cause issue. And then we'll talk about Polemus, Wagon Mound, and Dovey Mannheimer.